Hello, good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and I will be your host this evening as we talk about liver disease and the infection of the liver known as hepatitis. You know, the liver is the largest organ inside the human body, and it is vital to our overall health. Many things from hepatitis to medications can negatively affect the liver. Joining me tonight as we discuss issues with the liver is Dr. Hrishikesh Samat, Clinical Assistant Professor of Gastroenterology at Louisiana State University School of Medicine here in Shreveport, as well as Site Director of Hepatology at the John C. MacDonald Regional Transplant Center here in Shreveport at Willis-Knighton Health System. Dr. Samat, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Dr. Brewer. Thanks for having me.
So just to really start with some basic information, how does the liver function in the body? It's a large organ, so it must have a lot of responsibilities.
Yeah, so liver is the major filtering organ. It just takes out all the toxic things from our body, and it's the most vital organs. And that's the major organ which is important for survival of the body, I can tell you.
So I understand it does turn nutrients into chemicals that our body needs. It filters out lots of poisons and things like that.
It also produces some albumin, protective factors, some coagulation factors, which prevents bleeding. And it's a great source of neutrophils and all our immune system. It's one of the immune system organs.
So it's an immune organ, and yes. And it's a protein production factory, so to speak, for really important proteins in the blood.
Yeah, that's correct.
So this is Health Matters. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host tonight. We have Dr. Hrishikesh Samat here answering questions about the liver. And if you have any questions, you can call us tonight at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. So Dr. Samat, from your standpoint, I understand you're the site director of hepatology. Tell us what a hepatologist is and how one becomes a hepatologist. What was your training to become that?
So hepatology is a specialized branch which mainly concerns and mainly treats the patients with the liver disease. It's basically a super specialty, a subspecialty of a gastroenterology. So after your residency, you do a few years of training of gastroenterology, which is a general GI system, including liver. And then you need a few more years of training in liver. So after my gastroenterology, I was trained more in transplant and transplant hepatology. That's my specialization here.
How long does it take to become a hepatologist?
Gastroenterology training after 3 years of residency, medical school takes three more years and then two more years of training in liver.
So that's extensive training.
That's correct.
From the standpoint of studying the liver and the diagnostic tests that one looks at to discern whether the liver is healthy, how does one check out their liver?
So most of the time, the liver doesn't produce any pain. So it's most of the time patient is asymptomatic. They may complain of jaundice, which is yellowness of eyes, dark colored urine. But the best test to diagnose liver disease is checking their liver enzymes, liver function test, which is AST, ALT, and the bilirubin. That's the main thing we check whenever someone is suspected to have a liver disease.
So you mentioned AST, ALT, and bilirubin. These are enzymes that are actually detectable in the bloodstream?
Yes. So these are the enzymes are increased when the liver is injured. So AST and ALT are the one which get increased, and then bilirubin is one which follows that, and that causes jaundice.
And as I understand it, these are enzymes that are in the cells of the liver. So if the liver cells are breaking apart, let's say because of inflammation, these enzymes leak out into the blood and they're elevated.
Yes, that's correct.
But bilirubin's taken out of the blood by the liver, correct?
Yeah, so bilirubin is one of the excretory product. It is toxic to the body, but liver throws it out. So whenever that function is affected, it gets accumulated, and that's how we see that in the bloodstream.
And so when it's elevated in the bloodstream, it causes the pigments to change, correct?
That's correct.
In the skin.
That's correct.
It actually leaks out of the blood into the skin or maybe in the eyes, correct?
Yes, that's correct. It causes itching also.
So that's what the term jaundice means, correct?
That's correct. Jaundice is yellowness of the eyes.
And so that's a major sign of liver disease. What, and you mentioned there's not much pain. Are there any other signs of liver disease maybe that could be detected before one gets to the point of having yellow eyes or, as you mentioned, the Coca-Cola urine?
So a few people may complain of itching if there are problem with draining of this bile. But sometimes the disease is so asymptomatic, it progresses directly to the damage to the liver. And they present with confusion. Sometimes they come with the fluid accumulation in the belly, like a distended abdomen, swelling of the legs. And sometimes they can start throwing blood, like vomiting, hematemesis, vomiting of blood.
Oh, so actually ascites. So you're mentioning the fluid that accumulates in the in the abdomen when one has liver disease.
Yes, that's called ascites, and hematemesis when they start throwing up the blood.
So that's a fairly severe situation when that occurs, what I understand. Well, that's very, very important information. This is Health Matters here on Red River Radio. You are listening to 89.9 KDAQ, and we are talking about liver disease tonight. I'm your host, Dr. Randall Brewer. We have tonight Dr. Hrishikesh Samant, Clinical Professor of Gastroenterology here at LSU Shreveport and Site Director of Hepatology at the John C. McDonald Regional Transplant Center here at Willis-Knighton in Shreveport as well. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment about our topic tonight, you're welcome to call in. The number for that call is 1-800-552-8502. And if you are in the Twitterverse, you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. As well as Dr. Hrishikesh Samant, we have another guest with us here tonight who has just now joined us. He's just fresh here on the scene, and I'd really like to welcome Dr. Ray Coughlin to the discussion. Dr. Coughlin, thank you for joining us this evening.
Yeah, sorry for being a bit late.
Oh, that's fine. It's always, you know, it creates a little bit of excitement when somebody comes in and, you know, they're, you know, getting ready to get started and everything, and it's always a lot of fun just to get started talking about one of your really important things that you've run across in your career is infections of the liver. To this point, I'll just bring you up to speed, if it were. We've talked about what it is to be a hepatologist, which is what Dr. Samant is. We've talked about what the liver does. Apparently, it gets rid of bilirubin out of our bloodstream, and it also makes a number of very important proteins that help us to fight infections and help the blood to function normally, like clot normally and things like that. From your standpoint, I understand if you're concerned about an infection in the liver, how do you go about detecting that? We've talked about liver enzymes a little bit, but how would one know if they have a liver infection?
Well, you look for everything that can cause liver damage, or as many things as you can think of. We're all quite familiar with alcohol and its toxic effects on the liver. That doesn't mean you couldn't get an infection and use a great deal of alcohol or injure your liver. It doesn't even have to be a great deal of alcohol. Any toxins that might, I'm not sure you might have approached that already, but drugs, it's not uncommon for drugs to cause liver injury. And once you see that the liver's been injured, either because the patient in front of you becomes in yellow with their bilirubin that's not being excreted properly, or you have just, actually at this point in time, you have flu-like symptoms, which is a virus. And it's not uncommon for a physician to say, well, you have, or the patient to say you have flu-like symptoms, because the symptoms can be so vague. But back to your question about, you realize there's something wrong, you do some basic testing, blood testing, and if you think then that the liver, you define that the liver's injured, then you go looking for the problems, whether it's alcohol. And then you end up perhaps finding out it's not alcohol, it's not drugs, it's not another toxin, it's not something the patient's consumed. And then you look for viruses that can cause that kind of injury And when you start looking at viruses, there are many, many viruses that can cause liver injury or malfunction. It can be malfunctioned, but not permanently injured. So such as, well, we now have a list of hepatitis. We start with the alphabet, and we went A, then B, and then perhaps one we're going to talk about we couldn't figure out was non-A, non-B, now we call it C, and there's a few other alphabet letters. There's things like people are familiar with mono. Mono definitely attacks the liver, as do other Epstein-Barr-like viruses. So there's a long list of viruses that can actually injure the liver.
That's good information. We're going to talk a lot more about those viruses. So, Dr. Coughlin, you mentioned A, B, and C, hepatitis. When you detect that there's a liver infection, are there any ways of knowing whether it's A, B, and C when the patient comes in, or do you have to go ahead and do some very extensive testing to determine which of the hepatitis viruses the patient's infected with?
There's some very basic measurements. First of all, you take the history of the patient. If the patient's could be immunized or hepatitis A, then it's unlikely they have hepatitis A. If they have been immunized or hepatitis B, it's unlikely to non-exist to have hepatitis B, and then you look for the other viruses. There is no vaccine for hepatitis C. Once you've gotten that history, you start their basic tests, as you mentioned, some for antibodies to virus, hepatitis A virus, hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus. So you do those and then discern which one it is.
Excellent information. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. We have with us two very distinguished guests. We have Dr. Raymond Coughlin, Clinical Associate Professor of Infectious Disease here at LSU Health in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Hrishikesh Shamat, Clinical Assistant Professor of Gastroenterology, also here at LSU Health in Shreveport, as well as being the Site Director of Hepatology here at the John C. McDonald Regional Transplant Center. So, Dr. Shamat, going back to detecting liver disease, once it's detected, and let's say, for example, we've determined that it is a liver infection, let's say it's hepatitis, for example, do you treat an infection of the liver with anything specific to kill the virus, or are there things that we can do besides viral treatments to treat liver disease?
So if it is a viral infection, specifically like hepatitis B or hepatitis C, luckily we have medications. For hepatitis B, we have medication which can control the infection, and now hepatitis C is easily curable with the newer, completely oral antiviral medication. Apart from that, we also have to see how bad is the liver. So to stage the liver, is it really having some scarring, or it's still just inflammation of the liver, which can be completely reversed by treating these viruses with antiviral medication. So the treatment depends upon what type of infection you got of the liver.
Go back to the phone. Let's see if Amy is here. Amy, are you here with us on Health Matters?
I am.
Oh, thank you so much for calling us back. I apologize for the disconnection that occurred earlier, but please let us know what you're thinking about in terms of our topic tonight, liver disease.
Okay, so when my son was born, he was severely jaundiced, high bilirubin. They put him under the light for several days. Well, my question is, he is 28 now. Is he at a higher risk for liver disease or liver problems because of what he was born with? He was born 5 weeks early, and he had some serious medical issues when he was, infant. So is he at a higher risk for liver disease?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for asking that. So, Dr. Shamat, I know you're not a pediatric hepatologist, but neonatal hyperbilirubinemia, does it increase one's risk for liver disease later in life, or is that even a liver problem?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and this is a common thing we found. When preemie are born, they have difficulty in excreting this bilirubin, and they present with jaundice, which can be most likely, we call it physiological jaundice. Sometimes it can be pathological, but most of the time, the phototherapy, which you are discussing, normally helps, and the jaundice resolves. Now, this jaundice is just because immature system of the liver, and as the kid grows, the system becomes perfect as an adult, and normally they don't have any risk of future liver disease. So having neonatal jaundice doesn't have any increased risk of future liver disease, provided that jaundice is physiological, just the immature liver system.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling us here on Health Matters tonight. Again, if you have a question, please call us at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. So, Dr. Coughlin, when you determine if a patient has hepatitis, most likely, as you mentioned, it's going to be hepatitis C if one has not received the vaccination for hepatitis A and hepatitis B. Interestingly, are these vaccines recommended or required now? Or are they mandated? What's the status of hepatitis vaccination?
We're not mandated. We've never mandated a vaccine, particularly unless you're traveling into an area where there's large. I mean, there was no question. Smallpox vaccine at one time was mandated. Smallpox is almost eradicated now. Well, basically is eradicated. We were close to measles, but some people decided they weren't going to be immunized for measles, so we have a considerable blocks of measles outbreak in the United States. But so immunization for A and B are recommended. So an immunization for hepatitis B is given at birth. Hepatitis A is given later on, so it's not, you're not immunized at birth for hepatitis A. But now we give at birth. There, again, I was reemphasize the fact there is no vaccine or immunization for hepatitis C, and so that leaves us with a large number of people infected with hepatitis C over a long period of time. That so their liver damage actually we detect later after up to 20 to 30 years, we find the damage done. However, now that we're out looking for it more and more, especially in this state, and I say that thanks to our Secretary of Health, Rebecca Gee, we are on a march to eradicate hepatitis C from this state by 2024, which is achievable, we believe. But first of all, we have to capture those that have been infected. So again, there's no immunization for hepatitis C, but there is therapy for hepatitis C. And you asked if we kill the virus. We actually don't kill the virus. We just stop the virus from replicating with the drugs that are available. There are now drugs available that will kill a number of genetically different hepatitis C virus particles. So, but we have drugs that will now stop all of them replicating, and so that's even more impressive today.
We have a question that was sent in via technology, and Dr. Samana, I'll ask you this question. What are liver spots?
Liver spots. Spots are. It's a term. Whenever you do any ultrasound, any imaging of the liver by a CAT scan or an ultrasound or an MRI, and you found anything, any lesion on the liver, they normally we call it liver spots. But there is a huge differential of these spots. It can be a simple benign angiomas or which are just adenomas, to it can be a cancer. So in short, these liver spots need to be monitored and need to be seen by hepatologists. They need to be discussed.
I have another question coming in. It has to do with ethanol and intake. The questioner says, some doctors recommend that it's safe to drink alcohol in moderation. How much is safe for the liver and how much is unsafe for the liver? Now that it's after 5 o'clock, maybe somebody's, you know, having their evening drink and thinking about the liver, and should I stop or should I?
Should am they I safe stop with is the it, first drink or the?
Am eighth, I safe to continue?
Drink
or? Right, right. Dr. Coughlin, please.
Moderation is defined. We jokingly say in medicine, and this may be out there, is that the definition of an alcoholic is somebody who drinks more than their doctor. But so to point that in perspective, it's like mild, moderate, and severe. The more alcohol you consume, the greater your the risk to injuring your liver. So it's not predictable. So it's not like you can say 6 ounces, you're fine. 6 ounces of whiskey or something, you're fine. And 12 and a half ounces of whiskey a day, I'm talking about, will definitely injure your liver. It's really not predictable. There are many enzymes involved Caucasians, even among Caucasians, enzyme differences occur, and so people cannot consume alcohol without injuring their liver. There are other races where enzymes particularly play a role, and the consumption of alcohol in those particular races, and that they're usually subsets of actually of the Caucasian race. It's not a difference between black and white. There's the Indian population in North America, which is Caucasian, which has a higher risk of injuring their liver with any consumption of alcohol. But that again, the point is, it can vary from person to person. There's no numbers attached to how bad your liver will do with X amount.
Is it safe to say, if you're wondering with any substance, am I potentially doing harm with my ingestion or use? Probably a good thing to maybe talk about that with your provider and get some formal recommendations if you have concerns.
Right, and your provider should bring it up if he happens to measure your chemistries because you have high blood pressure and notices that your liver enzymes are abnormal. It's up to that provider to discuss with you the consumption of alcohol.
Do the genetic variations in alcohol, liver damage or predisposition for liver damage, does that have anything to do with the alcohol dehydrogenase variant for the metabolism of alcohol? I know that happens, in certain individuals. They don't metabolize it normally, if you will.
Yeah, so the Oriental population, they don't have this enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, and they don't tolerate the alcohol. They get flushing, and they get all the side effects of this metabolite of alcohol. And that's the thing. It's multifactorial. There is no one factor which can tell that whether alcohol is damaging your liver. So we have to consider whether there is underlying, like people who have fatty liver, of course, if they continue drinking alcohol, it's going to progress their liver disease.
Well, you bring up a great topic, actually. Fatty liver, what if you... a lot of people are overweight. What's it mean to have extra fat in your liver? What's that mean?
So fatty liver, it's completely a new diagnosis we got last 20 years. Previously, we used to call it like a cryptogenic liver disease. We didn't thought that this fatty liver is going to cause progression of the liver and cirrhosis. Now, basically, it's the fat which goes to the liver and which is not normal liver to have some fat, and it causes inflammation. And this inflammation continues, and over years, it causes scarring, fibrosis, and leads to cirrhosis. It is thought to be one of the most common cause of chronic liver disease in Western countries now. So apart from viral hepatitis, which is more on the eastern side of the world, fatty liver is the one which we are more struggling as a controlling the liver disease population in Western countries.
Oh, that's very interesting that you mentioned that, because obviously we have an obesity epidemic. We have a diabetes epidemic. So are you suggesting that we also have a fatty liver epidemic in our society or our culture as well?
Yeah. So interestingly, that's the main reason. If as the obesity epidemic and metabolic syndrome, you said, is the same driving factor, being fatty liver as one of the common cause of liver disease in our population.
Well, and let's say, for example, I have a little bit of diabetes. I'm a little bit overweight. I happen to drink quite a bit. And I get hepatitis. Am I really setting myself up for a bad situation with my liver?
It's like putting oil in your fire and then it's going to burn the liver. Yeah, it's just adding all the risk factors and it's going to definitely progress to cirrhosis more quickly.
So are there dietary recommendations? Let's say, for example, you test someone, their liver enzymes are elevated. And how do you determine if there is a fatty liver or if this is some other liver process that is taking place?
So fatty liver is normally a diagnosis by exclusion. We evaluate with, we rule out viral infections, we rule out autoimmune diseases. And if they fit into classical picture, they have overweight, BMI is more than 25 or 30, and they have underlying diabetic, or they have family history, then and the ultrasound shows fatty liver or some fat in the liver, then we tell them they most likely have a fatty liver disease. We avoid liver biopsies nowadays. We do more of imaging, follow them up. The main advice, right now we don't have any medications. They are all on clinical trial. They are in pipeline. But the only thing which is 100% effective is weight loss. If they can achieve 7% of their body weight, it is going to be reversible. The fatty liver is going to be reversible if they can achieve their weight loss.
And that's the same with early diabetes as well. It's getting the weight down. That's the ultimate treatment.
Yeah. So
absolutely. I think the fact that you just used that word epidemic, and we realized more and more that it's probably the largest present epidemic of liver disease in the country. We have lots of virus that we haven't detected, but the very fact that you brought up, I mean, the fatty liver and non-alcoholic fatty liver is the epidemic, not alcoholic induced fatty liver.
Cirrhosis from its conventional.
Like you brought up, obesity and poor distribution of fat in our bodies is a huge, huge problem and will be one of the major costs to our society.
You know, Dr. Samant and Dr. Colligan, you mentioned that, you know, it's obesity and diet-related. And you mentioned, is there a family history? I'm wondering if there is a genetic predisposition, because we see patients all the time who may have a BMI of 40. They're not diabetic. They may have a little bit of hypertension, but they're otherwise healthy. But the same, you know, we may see this a BMI even lower, let's say in the high 20s. Mm-hmm. The patient has, you know, raging diabetes that's poorly controlled, even on insulin, that's adult onset. So there has to be a genetic predisposition.
So the research has found one or two genes which are responsible. One of them is PNPL3, the gene they thought may be responsible more in lean fatty liver disease. People in eastern side, Japanese, they are no overweight, no BMI normal, and they come with the fatty liver. And they found that these are the genes may be responsible. One is PNPL3 and another gene they have found, but there is a lot of research going on whether genetic predisposition is there for fatty liver.
And, you know, just to sort of wrap up the fatty liver topic somewhat, are there dietary recommendations? And I know you guys are not dietitians, but patients are going to ask you this question, so I feel like it's my role to be a patient advocate and ask you a question a patient might ask. What can I do to change my diet? We know that carbohydrates, for example, you don't think of getting, you know, those being fatty things like, you know, cookies and things that are sweet, those are full of sugar, right? So can you get a fatty liver from too much sugar, just like you get diabetes from excessive carbohydrate intake?
Yeah, it's the same reason. The carbs, which converted into cholesterol, fat, and main advice we gave them to reduce their carbs, their intake or calorie intake, maybe more from proteins, which can help them.
I think
Until they get bad liver disease, and then they can't eat protein anymore, obviously.
That's right. You can't use protein. The other thing that is a point you made very well is that carbohydrate can do, as we know, much more damage than fat. We've come a long way in our learning curve in how we eat. And what is a good diet? But you don't want to say, I can't eat fat because I'm going to get a fatty liver. It's not true. They're not equivalent. You could eat more fat than we thought you could eat, and you certainly are more likely to get fatty liver from carbohydrates.
Yeah, and we have dietitians on the show all the time, and the ketogenic diet comes up pretty frequently, and fat is more filling, protein and fat. In equal proportion to carbohydrates is a perfectly well-balanced diet. The more complex carbohydrates that you can eat, the better, and avoiding simple sugars and things that are overly processed. All of those common themes come up. It doesn't matter what we're really talking about. We may be talking about being healthy for the new year, maybe talking about going into the holidays and having a good approach to health, or avoiding a fatty liver, avoiding heart disease, avoiding diabetes. It always comes back to that common denominator of choosing a lifestyle that's going to be healthy, based on your genetics and what you're able to do with,
still, it's hard
with exercise
to avoid,
as well.
Excuse me, but it's still hard to avoid the push of industry when it comes to processed foods. And we have many more restaurants go garden to table. We try more farmers markets around again locally that help us with our choices. So again, as you pointed out, if we can avoid our processed foods, we'd be doing wonders for our body.
We're talking about food, but actually we're also really supposed to be talking about liver disease, and we're going to get right back on that topic after I give you this really important telephone number, 1-800-552-8502. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. We are on Health Matters tonight. We are talking about liver disease, hepatitis, and the like. You can call and ask one of our excellent guests a question about this important topic, Dr. Ray Coughlin, Clinical Associate Professor of Infectious Disease here at LSU in Shreveport, and Dr. Hrishikesh Samant, Clinical Assistant Professor of Gastroenterology, also here at LSU Health in Shreveport. And he is also the site director of hepatology here at the John C. McDonald Regional Transplant Center, associated with the Willis Knighton Health System. So let's say, Dr. Samant, we've injured our liver. Tell us a little bit about, how does the liver recover? Is it something that regenerates itself? We know if you lose too much of your brain, it doesn't really grow back, but I understand the liver could be different.
So that's the interesting question. Liver is the only organ which regenerates. Liver has the capacity to regenerate, and it has been seen, because I'm a transplant hepatologist, we have seen when people donated a part of a liver in living donor liver transplant, we have seen their liver, when we take a partial liver, the liver regenerates, goes back to normal shape and size over a year. However, just wanted to mention, in a patient who has a scarred or cirrhotic liver, their liver doesn't regenerate normally. And that puts them at the risk of developing tumors and liver cancer. So even if liver regenerates, it doesn't regenerate when it is damaged with cirrhosis. So we have to make sure that when they get damaged liver or cirrhosis, they have to follow with their provider rather than waiting to regenerate.
So we're talking about monophasic illnesses, or if, for example, you have to have a liver resection because of a benign tumor, it's going to regenerate.
Yes.
But if you have a chronic illness that's hammering the liver every day, yes, it's not going to be able to naturally overcome.
That's correct.
Let's go ahead and go to our next caller. We have Ashley from Tyler. Ashley, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you. Yes, my question is around cholestasis of pregnancy. Do we know what causes it? And if somebody's had multiple pregnancies and had it with each one, are they susceptible to future damage later or permanent damage?
Great question.
Very good question. So cholestasis of pregnancy is completely a different entity. It's seen in only during pregnancy. There are some factors responsible, some genetic factors. Also, normally the cholestasis of pregnancy, it's completely benign. However, there is a risk of recurring, the risk of having cholestasis of pregnancy in every pregnancy. Normally, there is no fetal risk. However, they have shown that there is increased risk of IUGR, intrauterine growth retardation, or prenatal deliveries. But normally these pregnancies are safe. They reach to the termination and they reach to the full-term delivery, we manage very well. There are some medication we give for cholestasis of pregnancy. Most of the time, the only complaint they tell is itching. And of course, there is a risk of, reported risk of increased frequency of cholestasis each pregnancy, because the exact reason, we don't know. Most of the time, we think it's genetic or just the mechanism of liver of excreting the bile salts.
Yes, I've had it with three, so I understand.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling us here at Health Matters tonight. Again, if you have a question about our topic of liver disease tonight, please call us at 1-800-552-8502. So let's say, for example, we're managing liver disease and someone's coming to the liver clinic to see you, Dr. Samad. What would you tell them if you were considering the ultimate treatment for liver disease, which is obviously liver transplant? How does that conversation take place?
Normally when the patient when they have chronic liver disease, as you said, which is irreversible, and they come to a conclusion or they are referred for liver transplant, it's a big thing for not only the patient, but for the whole family. And liver transplant is not a decision made by a hepatologist or a single physician. It's a team decision. It involves a team of social worker, pharmacists to learn the medication, the surgeons who can explain the surgical procedure, the immunosuppression, and of course the hepatologist who walk them through this process of liver transplant. We have a cadaver liver transplant as well as living donor. We still have preferred cadaver donor transplant since there is a less risk. And we have achieved good success in outcomes. We have transplant center in Shreveport, and we have excellent outcome of liver transplant. So the thing is, it's a process. We need family support. We need a whole family to go through the process. However, the outcomes are great, and we have seen patients going back to their routine, normal life within 3 months of the transplant. And the outcomes are excellent, and normally that's the final thing if they have either cirrhosis of the liver, which is irreversible, or even if they get a liver cancer.
Let's go ahead and go to our next caller, and we're going to talk more about that because cancer is obviously a serious risk with liver disease. We have Matt from Marshall. Matt, thank you so much for calling us here at Health Matters tonight.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate what you guys do with Health Matters here on the radio. My question was, what do we think is the possibility of having bioengineered or 3D printed or cloned livers in the next 20 years? If you guys could just touch on that, that would be an interesting thing I'd like to hear about.
Excellent topic.
So
artificial liver
livers.
Transplant. Yeah.
If you read the recent articles, they were successful in making kidneys, artificial kidneys. Of course, 3D printing and all is very new, but the architecture of liver, it's so complicated. We're still in very early stages of developing something like this. Now, of course, there are bioreactors and they have grown hepatocytes, and we have tried to tide over the situation of acute liver failure. But still, I think we are still in very early stages of making a liver which can be transplanted in human organs. We think most of the time we are expecting kidneys may be the one which may come into maybe in 20 to 30 years. And at present, liver, because of its complex functioning and intricate architecture, I think it's difficult at this moment. But of course, the research is going on.
Excellent. Thank you for your time. I appreciate your answer.
Thank you, Matt, so much for calling us here at Health Matters. You know, Dr. Somani, you know, that really reminds me, that was probably my favorite section in the in the course where we learned about the physiology of the liver, and we learned about the histology of the liver, not just histopathology, but histology of the liver. Explain that a little bit, because it's a very intricate system where we have these sinusoids and we have these arteries that are going into specific parts of the liver, draining into the venous sinuses and a central vein in every functional unit. Explain a little bit about how complex the liver really is in terms of how it's put together and how difficult it's going to be. Unlike maybe bone or heart, for example, it's a complex organ.
So to just let you know the complexity, liver has dual blood supply. Maybe 30% of blood comes from a hepatic artery, which is just the main artery we think, but major blood supply comes from portal vein, which is the bad or the blood coming from intestine, and it filters into the liver. Now, liver filtration happens in hepatocytes, which is individual cell of the liver, but that's just the functioning unit. It has excretory function, which is done by the bile ducts and all, and plus it has a portal vein, which brings the bad blood. There is a hepatic artery flow, which filters the blood. There are a lot of things happening in the liver. It also manages the cholesterol, and it has an immune function. So it has a specific immune cell, which called Kupffer cell, which are present in the liver. So just imagining a liver architecture, it is just in the plates. There are multiple plates in multi-direction with these channels running in between the hepatocytes, which are constantly functioning, both synthetic function, which is producing proteins, coagulation factors, and excretory function, which is excreting out all the bilirubin and all the things which we don't want, which we eat from the food.
Yeah, so it's making a lot of protein to make things good. It's taking things away that is traveling to the liver, and then it's also serving a very important immune function. And so putting all that together in an artificial organ, that's going to be probably a Nobel Prize. Wouldn't you say, Dr. Coughlin, if they can come up with that?
I think it'd be, fabulous. But, we've at least, as Dr. Samant said, we're making inroads. Well, we're making inroads into great many things, but the liver also, one of the important things is that without the liver, we wouldn't clot our blood. And we don't think of it that way. And actually, one of the other things we teach students is if your bone marrow fails and your spleen fails, then your liver will make blood.
This is Health Matters. We have maybe time for one or two more questions. You can call us at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Another question that was sent in electronically has to do with a question that I get a lot, but I'm going to ask you because I think your input is key, because I usually defer to the hepatologist when I'm answering this question, especially with regards to patients who already have some GI or liver disease. And it's really, how much is safe in terms of taking acetaminophen or Tylenol? And that can be a segue into, how do we know if we're ingesting a drug that could be harming our liver in some way, and maybe some of the more common drugs that we do take routinely that could be challenging to our liver. So what would you consider in terms of a safe acetaminophen or Tylenol dose?
So, of course, there is a myth that a person with the chronic liver disease or cirrhosis cannot take Tylenol or acetaminophen. People, whenever I see a patient in the clinic, the first thing he says that I stopped taking acetaminophen, I'm taking some other NSAID, because I was told that since I have a liver disease, I cannot take acetaminophen. Now, that's a myth. A person with the chronic liver disease can tolerate up to 2 grams of acetaminophen, which is up to 2 tablets of 500 milligram of strength. Now, if the acetaminophen dose goes above 2 gram, that is going to cause accumulation and toxicity. But however, if you call me, if you tell me that they had some headache or migraine and they want to take pain medication, still acetaminophen is safer if they take less than 2 grams in a day. If they prefer taking, if they take NSAID, like ibuprofen or any Aleve, then that is more toxic to their kidneys and liver than Tylenol. So I always tell them that you can take Tylenol, but not more than 2 tablets in a day.
So 2,000 milligrams, and 2 tablets is usually 1,000 milligram, yeah, which would be an extra strength 500 yeah milligram acetaminophen. Let's say, for example, in a typical flu-like syndrome, Dr. Coughlin, someone has fever. One of the best antipyretics that we can take is acetaminophen. Is there a risk of having a synergistic effect on having liver damage from any viral illness, or does it depend on the type of virus if you're using acetaminophen in an acute illness such as the flu?
Well, you brought up earlier, if you're taking a drug and you're drinking a certain amount of alcohol and you've got some genetic predisposition to liver disease, then it certainly will add up. So if you have hepatitis, active hepatitis or chronic hepatitis, or likely chronic hepatitis, then it's generally safe to use the same amount of acetaminophen in most people. But we have many anti-inflammatory drugs, and we can't forget about the old anti-inflammatory drug aspirin, which lost its good name partially because of the fact that it can irritate your stomach. But there is not one non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent, the NSAIDs per se, that doesn't cause gastritis or irritate the lining of the stomach.
Dr. Samar, what would you tell patients with regards to other drugs? Let's say, for example, they're on a statin or they're on a drug for diabetes that has known toxicity to the liver. Is this something that they should monitor frequently or check with their provider about?
So I tell them, if any medication known to have some liver injuries, when they start the medication, they should repeat or check their liver enzymes in a week. Now, you brought the point of statins. So again, statins, of course, they can increase the liver enzymes. However, statins have significant benefits than the risk, and we monitor the liver enzymes. If the liver numbers are not really going high, we tell them to continue the statins, because now it has found to have antifibrotic or reversing the fibrosis of effect. So if somebody has diabetes or high cholesterol, he's taking statin and has some increased liver enzymes, we continue to tell them to take statins, because the benefits outweighs the risk.
All right, well, obviously, we need to make sure our liver functions are checked. Is this part of a routine history and physical when you see your doctor every year or every 2 years, however your schedule is set up? Should we be monitoring our liver functions on a regular basis, just like we check our blood pressure, maybe check our cholesterol, things like that?
There are some routine. So if you're on a medication, you should know what the medication's for. If you don't know what the medication's for, it's your provider's job to tell you what the medication's for, to know all the side effects. Not, and by all of them, I don't mean everyone that's listed in the little insert that goes with the drug, because there could be up to 200 side effects attached to some of them, which are very, very minor. But you should discuss all your medications time and time again. If you're on any medication, you carry them in whatever little bag you have when you go to the doctor. Don't leave them at home and go, oh, I'm not sure what the little white pill was. So your point, again, is very, very well taken. And again, don't be afraid to ask questions. If I'm on this, but I heard this, you know, and you say, well, I heard this attacks my liver, and should I have special liver enzymes or liver tests done? You know, should I be checked for hepatitis? Those are all very fair questions to ask. If you're not sure what the drug's doing or what you've been exposed to, which sort of segues into something I might say about if the United States Preventive Services Task Force has now put out a recommendation that everybody from the ages of 18 to 79, and we won't get into the 79 part, but be screened for hepatitis C once in their life. That's just about all of us. And the pediatric part they're working on. And again, certainly, again, the recommendation hasn't come out, but every pregnant woman is now checked for HIV disease. So the recommendation will be that every pregnant woman is also checked for hepatitis C.
Let's go ahead and go to our next caller. We have Elise from St. Augustine, Texas. Elise, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
You're welcome. My question is, what effect, if any, does primary biliary cholangitis have on the rest of the digestive system?
There's a lot of static and feedback, Elise, on the line, so I'm going to turn you down, but I'm going to repeat the question for our guests, and I heard it fairly well. What is the effect of primary biliary cholangitis on the digestive system if someone has this particular illness, Dr. Samat?
So PBC, or primary biliary cholangitis, is a part of autoimmune liver disease. It normally presents in late, more common in females. Now, it's an autoimmune disease. So normally it is associated with hypothyroid. They are at risk of autoimmune diseases like diabetes and skin diseases. The specific question you ask is about GI. So they have a decreased secretion. They have less production of saliva, less production of tears, and they present with dysphagia. Sometimes they have difficulty in swallowing, and this is sometimes not because of PBC, but it is because of associated scleroderma associated with PBC. So they have GI side effects which are not related to PBC itself, but it is related to a scleroderma, which is a different autoimmune condition, and it is commonly associated with PBC.
Thank you, Elise. Thank you so much for calling us here tonight on Health Matters. Dr. Coughlin, you mentioned something really important when it comes to detecting diseases early, before symptoms are severe or the chronic illness is present. Two-part question. Number one is, how do you get hepatitis C? Obviously, there's a way to spread it. And then number two, can you tell us a little bit about carrying it and whether you can pass it along if you're not symptomatic, like we mentioned with other diseases like HIV, for example? Or do you have to have an active infection with hepatitis and its symptoms in order to pass it along?
I love the two-part question, answer the problems with certainly with hepatitis C. Hepatitis A usually is a very acute disease. We used to call it yellow jaundice. Makes you very tired. You can be tired for months, but you're over it and you survive. Now, there is such a thing as fulminant hepatitis, whether it be A, B, or C, which can actually lead to transplant, but that's very unusual. Excuse me. So with hepatitis C, we found it was associated with blood years ago. We didn't discover the virus till 1889, know exactly what we were talking about. For years, though, we called it non-A, non-B. And we knew it was associated with blood in some way or other. So anything that's associated with blood and moving blood from one person to another is the number one way of transferring the disease. So intravenous drug users, whether it be once in your life, it only takes once to be pregnant, it only takes one use of an IV drug to get hepatitis C, if that person you're sharing a needle with has hepatitis C. The other ways are it used to be transfusion. So prior to 1992, we had no way of measuring whether hepatitis C was in your blood. Now we screen all blood for donors to see if there's hepatitis C and do not accept that blood. Previously, prior to 1992, we had people with hemophiliacs who needed blood products. We used plasma. We used many blood products. And we actually transferred the virus that way. So the other way is mother to child. There's about 6% of hepatitis C transferred from mother to child. It is not passed in breast milk, so that's an important to know. The other things I must say is that it's not transferred it's not transferred by using common products in the home, like drinking after somebody, eating after somebody. I'll just mention that again. Yeah. Now, the other thing, in working in a healthcare system, you can have a needle stick injury from somebody you don't know has hepatitis C and actually contract hepatitis C that way. That's uncommon, but it's definitely present. And many a surgeon in our society will tell you that they've operated on hepatitis C patients not knowing that and gotten a needle stick. So that can happen as well. And then sexually, at one time we thought 40% of hepatitis C was transferred sexually, but we've learned that's not even close. It's far less than that, far, far less. It's probably less than 2% at this stage. So we've corrected our statistics. Prior to improving tattoo artists and regulating our tattoo artists' needles, and that we actually transferred it that way. So you have to, if you're into tattoos, then you make sure that that the tattoo artist is adhering to regulatory practices, and you're entitled to ask that very question and how they sterilize needles, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, unless you're using needles or you're at risk at this time, you're not drug using. Even actually intranasal drug use increases your risk of hepatitis C. So again, I'll stop there. But I do want to say something about people who were treated for hepatitis C in the past. We used a drug called interferon, and it was very, very difficult to take. At those patients who gave up, we now have therapy that will cure this disease. More than 90% of people with hepatitis C can be cured. So, and we investigate people without using a needle stuck in their liver. We rarely do that anymore, and certainly not for hepatitis C. We have other modalities, tests, and even an ultrasound-type test that we can measure how much fibrosis there is in the liver.
Well, that is all the time we have for tonight. And Dr. Coughlin, that was very, very helpful information. I'd like to thank you and Dr. Samant for joining us here on Health Matters tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I've been your host this evening. It's been an honor and a pleasure to be with you. As you know, Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, its staff, or LSUS. This show will be available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with phone assistance tonight provided by Mr. Wally Derleth, Tim Snell, and Mr. Brian Boone. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This is 89.9 FM KDAQ Shreveport-Bossier City, 90.7 FM KLSA Alexandria-Pineville, 90.9 FM KBSA El Dorado, Camden, Magnolia, 88.9 FM KLDN Lufkin, Nacogdoches, and 100.7 FM KTYK Overton, Tyler, Kilgore. Thank you so much for joining us this evening on Health Matters.